From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lots of players in the news headlines this week. It's a packed stage with Blackwater's Eric Prince, Clarence Thomas, Jimmy Carter, Isaiah Thomas, Korean leaders hand in hand. In Washington, there was fresh uproar over interrogation and charges again of torture. White House spokeswoman Dana Perino said no.
What I can tell you is that any procedures that they use are tough, safe, necessary, and lawful.
Olympic track and field superstar Marion Jones admits to using steroids, but that's not what she said here in 2006.
I've always said, and I will continue to say, that I believe in a drug-free sport. I have never, ever taken a performance-enhancing drug.
That was then. On the campaign trail in Iowa, Republican presidential candidate Fred Thompson finished a speech and heard, well, silence. He had to do a little prompting.
First of all, could I have a round of applause? Well, I have a drag out of you, but now that we have, let's talk about what you want to talk about.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the week's headlines. You can join the conversation with S-Chip, Blackwater, campaign cash, and more. What's your top story this week? What matters? What's moving your world? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. With us today from Washington, Liz Marr, political blogger and columnist for the New York Sun. Liz, welcome back.
Hi, thanks. Good to be with you this morning, Tom.
Great to have you with us. With us from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal analyst for the online news magazine Slate. She covers the Supreme Court and has a great bead on the world. Dahlia, good to have you with us again as well. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Tom, Liz, and Dahlia.
Dahlia, take us first to this new buzz around interrogation techniques and the Justice Department. What do you know about what's going on there?
Well, I don't know that any of us knows much more than what the New York Times wrote yesterday, but that was quite a big story. And essentially, what we do know now is that even though the Justice Department and the White House were sort of very publicly repudiating some of the sort of shucking and jiving that they'd been doing about torture and the definition of torture and the sort of which kinds of practices they were deeming to be legal, they were doing that publicly even as that was going on in 2004. There were these sort of secret memos and authorizations and conversations going on behind the scenes that yet again raised all these questions that we thought we were resolving publicly about what was going to be allowed and what was not going to be allowed. In effect, I think what we're seeing is that even though publicly the White House was saying, okay, you know, we find torture abhorrent was the word that they used in 2004, very, very shortly thereafter, they were more secret memos coming out of a new Office of Legal Counsel that was authorizing some of the most extensive abuse that we've heard of to date.
Liz Mayer, do we ever get over this debate on interrogation, torture, the White House's credibility being called on the line here by some Democrats in Congress?
Yeah, well, I think the White House's credibility is being called into question on a lot of points at the moment. And I'm not actually convinced that we are going to get beyond this, because I think, you know, one of the fundamental issues that we have in relation to this question of torture is what qualifies as torture. And obviously, the administration has tried to pull off a couple of different definitions and tried to couch what they're doing in terms of it not being torture and in terms of it being lawful. And there is a real dispute about whether these techniques that are being used are, in fact, acceptable. And I think that that's at the root of this debate.
Jack, what do you say on the Justice Department legal opinions coming to light here?
Well, you know, it probably isn't the last we've heard of it. These are leaks from inside, from the professional people, and I expect they have more to come. You know, to me, the most emblematic comment was that by James Comey, who was the Deputy Attorney General, and he told his colleagues when they learned about these techniques, they would be ashamed. And isn't that what everybody feels here? You know, one wants with Joseph Welch to say to the president, at last, sir, do you have no shame? I mean, what is our country doing torturing people and then haggling over what constitutes torture?
But the White House says they're not torturing. They're doing what's necessary in a tough time.
Yes, they do. And probably if Osama bin Laden could utter up one policy for the United States to be known by, this would be it.
Well, there we go. President Bush vetoing the S-CHIP legislation on children's health care this week. He gave a speech in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, explaining why he delivered that veto.
The policies of the government ought to be to help poor children and to focus on poor children. And the policies of the government ought to be to help people find private insurance, not federal coverage. And that's where the philosophical divide comes in. I happen to believe that what you're seeing when you expand eligibility for federal programs is the desire by some in Washington, D.C. to federalize health care. I don't think that's good for the country.
Not good, says the president, to federalize health care. Republican Senator from Iowa, Charles Grassley, lambasted George Bush on the Senate floor this week, referencing President Bush's earlier weekend radio address when he called the S-CHIP bill irresponsible.
If you want to talk about the word responsible and whether Congress is responsible or not in this bill, I would say anybody that wants to leave the program the way it is, and that's what's going to happen with a veto, that's an irresponsible position to take.
Democrats in on the criticism as well. Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky from the 9th District in Illinois, frustrated that Republicans, some, wanted to veto S-CHIP, citing money concerns, but could somehow find money to fund the Iraq War.
The president and Republicans in Congress say that we can't afford this bill, but where were the fiscal conservatives when the president demanded hundreds of billions of dollars for the war in Iraq? He, along with many of the Republicans in Congress, are willing to throw these hundreds of billions of dollars into a disastrous war. And yet when it comes to providing health care to children, they say we don't have the money.
Liz Mayer, not surprising to see Democrats going after the president here, but what do you make of the fault lines within the GOP on this children's health care measure?
Well, I think S-CHIP is obviously something that is becoming a major topic of debate across the country. Clearly, of course, Democrats are going to attack on this. This is a good issue for them. They can wheel out 12-year-old kids to complain that the president doesn't like children and doesn't want to provide health insurance to children. In practical fact, though, there are a lot of problems with this bill. You know, Charles Grassley is right to a certain extent that the current system in relation to health care across the country is obviously not working the way that we would all like it to. But, you know, as to Jan Schakowsky's criticism of, you know, us having the money to fund the Iraq War, but complaining that we don't have the money to fund this, I mean, one of the major problems with this bill is that the way that the Democrats intend to pay for it is by increasing taxes on cigarettes and tobacco products. And in actual fact, the tax that they're trying to impose because of the level of smoking in this country isn't actually going to pay for what they want to do. So there are some very serious problems with this bill and with the entire proposal. Fault lines are being drawn, as you say, within the Republican Party and between the president, obviously, and the Democrats. And I think it's going to be a very interesting issue to see play out.
But Dahlia, you know, the Republican critics of this bill say, well, how high up the income ladder do you want to take this kind of government support for children's health care? And they put some pretty big sounding numbers out there, $80,000, for example.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that's been most roundly debunked in the last 2 days. That number that the president cited to, you know, that they want to raise
the families with a household income as high as $80,000 would get support, I guess.
$82,000, mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is just absolutely wrong. What that number represents was a request by New York State under the program who wanted to raise up to 400% of the poverty line, and they made a request and they said, here's what we want to raise it to because the cost of living in New York is so high, and they were told no, and that was the end of it. And certainly the Bush policy could continue to be, you know, we're going to stay at 200%, we're going to stay at 300%, $82,000 is not acceptable, but that number does not represent any reality. Nobody under this program is trying to raise it to 400% of the poverty level, and so I think it was just a misstatement, as was the misstatement that I think folks caught in the clip you just played, where he's talking about federalizing or health care or having government insurance. S-CHIP would put people, poor children, into private insurance. So again, you know, this whole slippery slope analysis that we're one short hop from, you know, some kind of communist socialized medicine. It's just fear-mongering. That rhetoric is absolutely wrong.
Jack, how do you then read the president's position here? I mean, there's a lot of gears grinding on health care. Lots of mainstream Americans fearing, of course, if they lose a job or somehow slip, their whole family loses coverage. But why would the president go so hard on this one? What's in it for him?
Well, this seems to be part of a veto strategy. There's a 1% difference between the president and the Democrats on domestic spending, $22 billion. 1% is the difference between what the president proposes and what he says he will settle for and what the Democrats want. And the president, who didn't see fit to veto a single spending bill through the 6 years of Republican dominance, now says, threatening to veto nearly a half a dozen Democratic bills. This is one of them. And I think it's an effort to, you know, give the fiscal responsibility credential some long overdue warming. But it's so short-sighted, and talk about short-sighted. All of the major Republican candidates have now backed the president on this veto, backed them while 72% of the public said they want additional spending on it, backed them while 67% of the public said they want less spending on the Iraq and Afghanistan war. So it's going to why the Republican candidates have done that is it just allows the Democrats to, it seems to me, to attack them for lack of compassion. And there is a Dickensian quality to this, you know. You kind of kick the kid away and say, well, you come back for your bowl later on. And I think it really does play to the Democrats' strength.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, and you can join the conversation. Do you agree with Barack Obama that nuclear weapons should be abolished? What's your top story this week? Are you sick of hearing the United States and torture in the same sentence, or do we just have to live with that? Liz Marr is with us, political blogger, columnist for the New York Sun. Dahlia Lithwick is here, senior editor and legal analyst for the online news magazine Slate. Jack Beatty's here as well. Join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, more Blackwater blues, campaign cash. The Supreme Court is back. Marion Jones in trouble. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What's moving your world? Where are you on S-CHIP, on child's health care that the president calls a government run? Is it time to bring Blackwater home? And are the issues getting lost in money talk on the campaign trail? Or is money the point now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Dahlia Lithwick of Slate joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia today. Liz Marr of the New York Sun and with her political blog joins us from Washington. Jack Beatty's here as well. Let's take a call right now from Waterloo, Iowa. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call, Tom.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that all of those individuals who have been concerned that the Democratic Congress, once elected in the Senate, has not gotten anything done, stand up and take notice. Here's a circumstance in which we've got bipartisan agreement, and the Bush administration is still not allowing it to pass. I think he's going to ride that horse. He's going to say, well, they're not getting anything done, but pay attention. Who's not working with whom? It's really important that we realize and don't penalize those elected officials who are struggling to get something done.
Yep. Karen, we've got the perspective, and it's loud and clear. Let me get another, if I may, from Milford, Connecticut. Martin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a physician, and I want to emphasize the absurdity of the president's position. $400 billion a year is spent in overhead by privatizing insurance. The Medicare program has a 2% overhead. They treat the sickest people. Privatization costs somewhere between 15 and 25% overhead. That $400 billion a year is not only enough money to insure children, it's enough money to insure every man, woman, and child in the United States and provide full drug coverage for seniors.
So the doctor says, let's go right down that S-CHIP road. Martin, thank you. Let me get a call from Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi. Actually, I'd just like to amplify a little bit on that last comment. What you see is a confluence of two stories here, the Blackwater story and the S-CHIP story, and they all have the same root. It's an ideological preference for the private profit over the public good. And the reason for that is not just some philosophical idea, as the president said, but it's a political calculation. It's the one Rove has made for decades, and that is that to the extent that people benefit from government services, they believe they're more likely to be Democratic voters. And so they want to drain the swamp of Democratic voters by privatizing as much of the government as possible. And the result is that you have a private mercenary army, equal in size to our own troops, that are going off and doing things that we pay for, not just in cost of money, but because they damage our foreign policy objectives, and at the same time, we're unwilling to pay a pittance in health care for these children.
Mark, we've got the perspective, and you turn here on the private pivot to Blackwater as well. That, of course, was huge in the news this week, and let's keep S-CHIP in mind, but listen to a little bit of that. CEO of Blackwater USA, Eric Prince, testified before a House Oversight and Government Reform Committee hearing on Tuesday. Representative Danny Davis, Democrat from Illinois, asked if innocent Iraqis had been shot by Blackwater.
You do admit that Blackwater personnel have shot and killed innocent civilians, don't you?
No, sir. I disagree with that. I think there's been times when guys are using defensive force to protect themselves, to protect the package they're trying to get away from danger.
Committee Chairman Henry Waxman said at the same hearing, State Department isn't doing a very good job of overseeing Blackwater's activities.
As I view the record, it shows that the State Department is acting as an enabler to Blackwater tactics. The company acts as if they were untouchable for a simple reason. The State Department demands no accountability.
Liz Mayer, here's a public-private debate that is kind of new, even though Blackwater's been around now. It's grown so big. What did you make of this week? I mean, here's privatized or private armed guys, many of them protecting U.S. government officials in Iraq. Do you sense Washington becoming just too uncomfortable with this to let it go on? What about Republicans?
Well, I think evidently, in terms of the oversight of what Blackwater are doing, obviously there is a sense of discomfort with what is perceived as a lack of oversight. Otherwise, the House would not have passed this bill allowing for the prosecution of U.S. contractors by a 389-30 margin. So, I mean, that's pretty bipartisan. But I think, you know, talking generally about sort of, you know, the privatization angle, there is a serious point to be made here that, first of all, the purpose of our military is not necessarily to be going around guarding State Department officials. So, you know, that's point number one. Also, you know, one of the points that I think Henry Waxman made when he was speaking about this yesterday was that, you know, if we were intending to have people effectively acting in a military capacity, then what we should be doing is increasing the amount of military that we have in Iraq, which I think is kind of a funny statement to be coming from this guy because he clearly does not support sending more troops into Iraq. So there are a lot of issues that come out of this.
Let's get a perspective, if I may, Jack, for just for a second. From Nashville, we've got Ray on the line on just this point. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to address that because I'm a general contractor, and I've worked by contracts all my working life. And to not be able to hold your subcontractors or your suppliers or even me contracting with an owner, to not be able to hold them accountable is just bizarre to me.
So are you talking about Blackwater here then, Ray?
Yes, sir. Since that was the point on hand.
But Blackwater says, look, we're told to guard these people, and we do that. None of them have died under our protection.
I understand that, but I just heard the lady say that, you know, that's not our military's obligation to guard diplomats. But if we go in, if our military takes over a country, it is their obligation. It's no one else's obligation. They've destroyed that country's political structure. They are responsible until they get it up and running again. I think it is their responsibility.
If it's all part of an invasion, maybe it does fall in their lap. Ray, thanks for that. Jack, I'm sorry I interrupted you there.
Well, it came out in the hearings this week. John Tierney, a Democrat from Salem, Mass., brought it out that there, in fact, are 160,000 contractor personnel in Iraq, just about, as our caller Mark said, just about the same amount of U.S. troops. Not all of them are in security. Not all of them are American. Most are. And Tierney made the point that an average of about 9 of them have been dying a week, which I checked the figures as of June was about 1,000 dead. And his point is that this is kind of an off-the-books way of doing the war. And in other words, the casualties aren't counted in the U.S. military fatalities. And a second point about this privatization is, of course, that it's very profitable for the Republican Party. Blackwater, the Eric Prince's sister, was a pioneer, raising $100,000 for the Bush campaign. Prince himself, Blackwater, which was practically an unheard of company before this war, now making $1 billion. They gave something like over $300,000 to Republican candidates in some recent years.
That's a small share of $1 billion.
Yeah, and it's a good deal. So privatization not only, and then the other point is, of course, it's not efficient. It costs seven times more than the U.S. Than it would cost to have a U.S. soldier doing any of these things. So this is part of that Rovian picture, I think, of you privatize and in return you get the campaign contribution.
But as Liz Mayer points out, pushback in the House this week. Let's take a call from Charlotte, North Carolina. Justin, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I would like to, if I had the privilege of maybe responding to how people react to my comment. There was a lady, a congressman, who said that she doesn't feel like we should be spending millions of dollars in the Iraq war without really spending millions of dollars on S-CHIP.
Right, we heard the tape.
Right. I would like to say that the role of our government, if you think back to our Constitution, how it was founded, one of the primary roles of government is to fund the military. Whether or not you agree with the Iraq war or not, if we don't continue to fund the military in this war, we're going to have U.S. soldiers dying. If we pull out too early, the Middle East will be destabilized. We have to continue to fund the Iraq war.
All right, Justin, let me have you bring that into a conversation with Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, Justin puts it a little bit in your wheelhouse with the Constitution here. He says the government has to pay for the military. The military is in Iraq. That trumps children's health care.
Well, I mean, I think Justin is right, as a sort of a rhetorical matter. I think it's a mistake to say that there's an either or here. You know, fund the war, fund S-CHIP, because, you know, we're in it. We're in it, and we can't just pull out. And clearly, that's a much larger conversation. I don't agree on the specific that, you know, therefore we need to stay in forever regardless of what happens. But I do want to say that where I differ with Justin is I think the thrust of that argument wasn't, you know, pull out of Iraq and fund S-CHIP. It was President Bush has been spending money like, you know, a crazy socialite at Saks Fifth Avenue. I mean, he's running around spending money on everything. There's more pork. There's more, you know, just tax cuts for the rich. And so I think that the point that she was trying to make rhetorically, and it's not wrong, is to say, don't stop now. This is not the issue on which to plant your flag and say, oh, now we have to be thrifty.
Don't draw the line on kids' health care. Justin, what do you say to that,
point.
Justin? Thanks, Dylan.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah. Okay, I'd like to respond to that because yeah. I think that think about the role of our Constitution. There's no paragraph in the Constitution saying we must fund everybody's health care. I mean, we have a free enterprise society, and we actually were founded as a society of individualists. I mean, I think we almost have to say, okay, the cost of health care are escalating so much, the government cannot continue to fund everybody's health care.
What about the cost of war? We're in Iraq to save lives, but we don't want to be in the business of saving lives at home. I mean, it's tough. They're tough trade-offs, aren't they?
But that's the war. I mean, the government funds the military, but it was Lyndon Johnson's idea that the government should fund people's health care when they retire. That's not necessarily a constitutional idea. It's not necessarily an American idea.
Justin, we've got the point, and you make it very clearly. Liz Mayer, you've got the conservative leaning here. What do you make of the way Justin lines out his spending priorities and government obligations here, our government obligations?
Well, I think Justin's got a point insofar as, you know, in the system that we've got, in a federal system, when you're looking at what the federal government's responsibility is, I mean, one of the main things that it's got to be responsible for is funding the national defense. That's just a point of fact. I think it's also interesting that the caller brings up Lyndon Johnson, because, I mean, this is where we hit the problem with the way that the president is messaging on this issue. He has, according to studies done, I think, by the Cato Institute, he has actually expanded government by the same sort of measure as Lyndon Johnson has. And I think that's one of the problems that you see in this debate is that there is a principled argument for saying that we should not proceed with the S-CHIP expansion that the Democrats want. I don't think that the president's very capable of making that given the way that he's conducted himself over the last few years.
I want to turn to another front here, and Dahlia, this comes to your turf. Clarence Thomas is talking this week after 16 years of largely public silence on his bitter confirmation hearings. In an exchange here with 60 Minutes correspondent Steve Croft, Thomas, who's making the rounds with his new memoir, My Grandfather's Son, had harsh words about Anita Hill, whose sexual harassment claim nearly derailed his Supreme Court confirmation. We first hear from Steve Croft.
Was the Anita Hill that testified on the Hill, the Anita Hill that you knew at EEOC?
She was not the demure, religious, conservative person that they portrayed. That's not the person I knew.
Who was the person you knew?
She could defend herself. Let's just put it that way.
She could defend herself, says the Supreme Court Justice. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Then, in an exclusive interview with ABC's Good Morning America on Tuesday, Anita Hill stood by her long-ago accusations against then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas.
I understand that he is very angry, and he wants to vindicate himself. But in fact, when I testified in 1991, I was truthful. What I described happened actually did happen. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned over the years is that it's happened to many people in the workplace.
Anita Hill pushes back against the sitting Supreme Court justice now. Dahlia Lithwick, take us behind beyond the Hill-Thomas confrontation. That's interesting, too. But here we've got Clarence Thomas, after such a long time, kind of striding out on the public stage. What do we see?
Whew. Tom, this book is truly one of the most painful books, biographies that I've read. I mean, it is absolutely just the most odd amalgam of a sort of Ayn Rand, Fountainhead, you know, self-made man, don't rely on anybody, I am what I am because my grandfather taught me, you know, essentially to stand up for myself and to trust nothing. And then in the exact same moment that he's doing that, it is a bitter, bitter sort of recitation of one humiliation after another that he has suffered, just a very, very angry pushback against feminists, against the Senate, against, you know, the liberal, quote, mob that he sees as sort of having taken him down for being an uppity black man. It is a very hard book to sort of puzzle through and figure out. I mean, beyond just, I think, the unseemliness of these sort of cartoonish caricatures, and we heard it just there, you know, you don't need to call Anita Hill a mediocre employee. You don't need to say she's not demure. That kind of thing is so not befitting a justice. Mm-hmm. But beyond just that, just trying to puzzle through how this man has been so wounded and how he has become 16 years later, you know, not one little bit reconciled or at peace, you know, to go back and pick at that scab of the he says, she says, which, by the way, I don't know that he wins on the merits. I mean, I don't know that he wants to go back and relitigate, Anita Hill versus Clarence Thomas, because the evidence is not necessarily on his side. So it is just a very, very strange and puzzling effort. And as I say, just very painful to read.
Dahlia, does this memoir tell us anything looking out on the court's agenda in this term? We're looking forward with the court that we don't already know. Does it give us any new insight through the prism of Clarence Thomas on the entire court, or is this all about the world of Clarence?
Well, you know, he's very, very careful. He stops talking, you know, when he has his investiture to the court, and that's obviously very appropriate. He doesn't want to sort of be weighing in on legal constitutional questions that may come before him. So, I don't think that in any sort of direct way we can read the tea leaves into, you know, the coming term or the coming years on the court. What it gives us terrific insight into, though, is his view of these sort of thorny, particularly race and gender questions that come before the court. I mean, we certainly have a way of understanding why he is so vehemently opposed to affirmative action, for instance. He sees it as having, you know, destroyed his life. He thinks that having attended Yale Law School and then not been sort of given the benefit of the doubt of having achieved that on the merits, he said in his interview with Steve Croft, he stuck a 15-cent sticker on his Yale diploma, his Yale Law School diploma, and chucked it in the basement because it means nothing to him. So we certainly do, I think, have terrific insight into how his own personal narrative has imprinted his jurisprudence.
A hard story. Jack, just a word there?
Well, and also his money-raising skills. He's getting over $1 million for this, and last year the Los Angeles Times did an expose of his accepting all kinds of gifts from people around the country, including regularly new tires for his car.
Well, okay, we've got to drive. Jack Beatty, Dahlia Lithwick with Slate. Liz Marr, political blogger, columnist for the New York Sun. Please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. What do you say about Isaiah Thomas and his sexual harassment troubles? How about Jimmy Carter's shouting match in Darfur? What's your thought now on Larry Craig? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Jenna Bush is out with a new book on a teenage mother with HIV. On the CBS Early Show, she, Jenna Bush, was asked whether all the talk of safe sex and condoms went against her Republican upbringing.
I'm not sure what the Republican Party, you know, but I don't know. But no, it's not against what I brought up with. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think all parents agree that kids need to be educated.
In La Jolla, California this week, landslide.
We heard trees falling, all the pine cones were dropping off the trees, dogs were going crazy, and the ground actually started to lift up in front of us.
And with summit talks this week between North and South Korean leaders, South Korean protesters chanted down with the North's Kim Jong-il. We're looking at a week in the news. What's your top story this week? Let us know. We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Liz Mayer is with us with the New York Sun. Dahlia Lithwick from the online news magazine Slate. And Jack Beatty's here. You can join us, 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Anthony in Providence, Rhode Island. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to comment on that the article in yesterday's Times and ask a question or make an observation.
Are you talking about the interrogation memo with the Justice Department? Yep, that's come to light, yes?
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think Mr. Comey was absolutely correct that it's shameful the way we're splitting hairs over the fundamental question of how we can treat prisoners or detainees. But I think there's a broader question that underlies this whole thing that really needs to be addressed. And that's the question of who's, in essence, who's more powerful, the president or the Congress under our Constitution. The thing that underlies the president's approach to this is that as commander-in-chief, he can do anything that's not unconstitutional, even if Congress declares it unlawful. And that raises, I think, the fundamental question over who did the founders intend to be more powerful, the chief executive, whom they feared like a king, or the Congress.
Anthony, let us take that and go first to Dahlia Lithwick, and then maybe, Dahlia, we can pivot to what else is on the Supreme Court's calendar in this term coming up. But there's the concern. It's been raised so high during the Bush administration. Do you see anything on the court's agenda that will change it? Do you see the tenor in Washington ready to push back against executive powers expansion?
You know, such a good point Anthony makes, and I think it's really, you know, the central sort of theoretical drama that we are going to be struggling with for years to come, long after President Hillary Clinton takes office, is how strong the presidency became under President Bush and how much he sort of used, I think, many, many of these issues, you know, of torture, of surveillance, to in fact strengthen the executive branch. And I think that the sort of underlying what Anthony says, there's this very important theme, which is, and, you know, we're really hearing it now, for instance, Jack Goldsmith, who is the head of Office of Legal Counsel, has got a new book that's come out called The Terror Presidency. And one of Goldsmith's arguments, I think it's spot on, is that everything that the president tried to achieve unilaterally, tried to assert unilaterally, he could have gotten from the Congress. He could have gotten, had he been more reasonable, had he gone to tried to deal with the Congress and to accommodate the Supreme Court. And so in a sense, what he did was by asserting the sort of Nixonian vision of the Constitution, you know, if the president does it, it's never illegal. And that's really, I think, been the thrust of the, for instance, the John Yoo torture memo. That's been the thrust of their arguments about warrantless surveillance. it. If the president does it, it's never illegal. And I think the pushback, and you know, as Liz said, the scandals have been immeasurable as a consequence. So I don't know that we are going to have any good answers for a long, long time about how strong the executive should be as compared to the other branches. But I do know that I think ultimately the president did not help himself. Just quickly, a flick to your second question about the court. The most important case in which that issue is going to come up before the court is going to come up in this Boumediene case, which is the absolutely critically important question about how many rights the detainees at Guantanamo Bay have to bring their cases before a habeas petition, to bring it before the federal courts. And that really goes to this core issue of separation of powers. How much power does the Congress have to strip these detainees of their habeas rights, as they have done now through legislation? How much power does the court have to sort of say, no, you cannot strip habeas? The Constitution says you can only do it in certain circumstances. So these very, very thorny, but I think fundamental constitutional questions about the role of the president in wartime, the role of the courts, the role of the Congress are coming up, you know, on the docket. And I think there's probably no question, based on what the court has done in previous years with these broad, broad executive claims, we're going to see the court probably by a 5-4 margin say, no way. You can't take away all the rights of these detainees. Habeas is too fundamental.
Jack Beatty, you've been looking at that Supreme Court docket as well with reference to American voters and voting.
Yes, a voter ID case is coming up. Maybe Dahlia can talk more about it. But more than 20 states passed laws since the Florida fiasco requiring photo IDs for voters. In all of those states, it was Republican legislators pushing it. And a federal court, the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, approved an Indiana law that was among the most onerous of these identification laws. Judge Posner wrote the majority opinion, and in his opinion, he conceded, yes, this will tamp down the Democratic vote because these are predominantly elderly, poor, and or black voters, minority voters, who'll be affected, but it needs to be done to combat voter fraud. Well, you know, this issue of voter fraud is almost notional. It's almost a figment of people's, of the conservative imagination. The Georgia Secretary of State, when Georgia passed one of these voter ID laws, said she could have, she found no case of voter fraud in the state to which this law presumably was directed. This is a very serious business. I think it threatens to roll back voting rights for African Americans considerably. And if this Supreme Court allows these laws to go ahead, calls them constitutional, it could have a bearing on the 2008 election.
There's a concern on the table. Let's turn to that election itself. Dolly Lithwick impishly referring to President Hillary Clinton there. Former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich last weekend on ABC's This Week talked about the strategy a GOP candidate, whoever that may be, would need to go up against Hillary Clinton.
Now, the question is, let's take her as a very solid professional, competent person, and say, does America want to go where she would take America? And I think a candidate who can calmly and cheerfully and pleasantly draw that contrast, say, terrific person, works hard, she's just wrong.
There's Newt Gingrich on Hillary Clinton. She's leading by a wide margin in the latest national polls. Liz Mayer, what are you seeing on the GOP side, on the Democrat side, in the way issues are being rolled out, cash is being accounted for, the campaign's moving forward?
Well, talking cash first, I mean, obviously we've had new fundraising numbers that have just come in, and sort of the surprising news, I guess, to me on the Democratic side is that, you know, thus far we've seen Obama doing a very good job of matching or outpacing Hillary when it comes to raising money. This time around, it looks like she's beat him. So this is starting to create a situation where it looks like her becoming the Democratic nominee is kind of a predetermined conclusion. On the Republican side, we've seen this quarter Giuliani come out raising more than the other Republican nominees. Admittedly, he's beat Romney by not a whole lot, given that a certain amount of the money that he he's taken in is actually for the general election campaign, not for the primary. One of the interesting stories, I think, on the Republican side is Fred Thompson, who has raised a bit more money than what I think people were initially expecting, mm-hmm. but who has been burning through his money at an alarmingly high pace. And one tends to wonder exactly on what. The guy hasn't been out there actively campaigning nearly as much as the other guys yet. I think the statistic is that he spent something like 45% of the money that he's raised to date.
We heard that awkward moment at the top of the hour, Dahlia, where Fred Thompson had to ask his Iowa audience for a little applause, please.
Yeah, poor Fred Thompson's had a tough week. He's had, you know, just a couple of terrible missteps. I think there's this perception that he's just not a very good campaigner, that he gets out there and all that magical TV, you know, sparkle that he's supposed to be, you know, that Reagan-esque actor quality just kind of has fizzled. You know, it's obviously very early. There's this very, very strange media obsession with his, quote, trophy wife that I don't even want to touch. Mm. But it's definitely
much younger than him, blonde and said to be ambitious. But how many stereotypes can we juggle at once here?
Yeah, no, it's almost as pernicious as the incredible focus on Hillary Clinton's laugh, which has become the front page story too. But I do think that Thompson, you know, he was a sort of a lackluster senator. I mean, he wasn't all that interested, and he said that, you know, in being in the Senate and standing there all day and, you know, debating over bills. And so I have a sense that he's sort of feeling a little lackluster about the presidency. It's a very, very strange performance from someone who was meant to be, you know, this sort of stealth guy. He was going to think about it and think about it and then come blazing out, you know, and knock us back on our heels. And I think he's been just absolutely underwhelming thus far.
Jack Beatty, what do you see on the campaign trail this week?
Well, Fred has a rendezvous possibly with embarrassment in the Republican debate next week. He clearly is unprepared. He referred this week to a country called the Soviet Union. That's just one of number of these maunderings. But, you know, to me, the remarkable thing is Hillary Clinton's consolidation, 33-point lead now nationally over Obama. And this, after what most people thought was a very weak performance in the last debate, where she refused to answer questions, she wouldn't commit herself on what to do about Social Security. She made a very questionable vote on Iran. Now, 2 weeks ago, she voted against she voted for the Lieberman Amendment that effectively declared that the Quds force in Iran was a terrorist organization. Mm. Jim Webb called that possibly tantamount to a declaration of war. Now she says she's going to vote with Jim Webb on an amendment that would require the president to come to Congress first if he wanted to make war on Iran. So she's covering all the bases there. So she makes these sort of, and then her vapidity in that debate. Gail Collins had a column in which she just quoted some of the things Hillary had said and juxtaposed this against Bill Clinton's comment that she was the best mind of her generation. And Gail Collins was saying, wait a minute, how can she talk this ragtime and still be the best mind of her generation? So it doesn't seem to matter how she's performing. She keeps going up.
33-point lead, though, Jack. Somebody's seeing something a lot that you may not there. Bill Clinton, interestingly, appeared Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press with Tim Russert. He was asked what he would do if Hillary is elected president.
But I will do whatever I'm asked to do. I don't care what I'm called. I don't care where my office is. I just want to do whatever helps her most. I think that's what you do if you've been president and you get a president. That's the fact that, you know, our situation is unique. Doesn't change that. I think I owe that to any president, but particularly to her. I just wanted to, whatever she wants me to do, I'll do.
Whatever she wants me to do, I'll do, says Bill Clinton there on with Tim Russert. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Bennington, Vermont, and Rachel. Hi, Rachel. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a question for your experts regarding the photo ID for voters in different states. I guess it's in two parts. One is, in all these requirements, has the state offered to pay for the voter ID? And if it's not, doesn't that sort of just amount to another poll tax? And I thought that was unconstitutional.
Jack?
In fact, in Georgia, the state did require that, and the federal court there ruled that, in fact, that did violate the constitutional ban on a poll tax.
Dahlia, what do you say on this one?
I think Jack nailed it earlier when he described the issues. I think this is just a huge, huge boogeyman. There is no evidence whatsoever that there is a huge vote fraud epidemic in America. And yet that has not only driven these voter ID laws, which, as your caller points out, are very, very, very problematic, very much akin to poll taxes. And there is good evidence that for somebody to have to go 30 miles on a bus to go get a piece of ID when they, you know, the Department of Motor Vehicles is only open during business hours. I mean, this is a very, very cumbersome and onerous requirement. But it's not only the sort of constitutional problems. It's, as Jack says, there's just no evidence that this is a problem that needs to be remedied. And yet, this whole vote fraud thing has really animated so much of what's gone wrong. It's one of the things that lurks behind the U.S. attorney firings. It's one of the great Rovian visions of what he was going to do, on the Justice Department. Watch, and it is really undergirding this whole voter ID case. There are very, very, very crucial questions about: do we want to sort of increase voting, particularly minority and the elderly and the poor, or do we want to decrease it? And it's hard to see a reason to want to decrease it.
Our time grows short. A lot of things we haven't even been able to touch yet. But let me just ask Liz Mayer, Larry Craig, Senator Larry Craig of Idaho, says he's going to hang in there in spite of the fact that he's not going to be, or hasn't been yet allowed, to challenge his earlier guilty plea and try and take it back. How do you see this thing playing out?
Yeah, I think that this is bad news. His lawyer, yesterday, from what I understood, his lawyer was arguing that when Larry Craig said that it was his intention to resign if he couldn't withdraw his guilty plea, that wasn't actually signaling that he would resign. That was saying that was something he was sort of thinking about at that particular point, and now he's decided that he can operate effectively within the Senate, so he's not going to go. In terms of representing his constituents, I don't know. Maybe he can represent them effectively within the Senate. But as far as I'm concerned, he, by issuing that guilty plea, he has admitted that he's committed a crime. And as far as I'm concerned, under Senate ethics rules, you shouldn't have sitting senators who are admitting to committing crimes. I think that that's bad news. And it's particularly bad news for the Republican Party. The chair of the National Republican Senatorial Committee has said that he would definitely like Larry Craig to stick with his previous commitment to go. And I think that that's a widespread sentiment across the party at this point.
Jack Beatty, and then we go to the deserts of Sudan and Darfur, and there's former President Jimmy Carter standing under that sun, reportedly in a big shouting match with Sudanese security. This guy, he just keeps going. You've got to give him that.
You sure do. He said, and he made the comment, he says, I'm not used to being stopped when I want to go someplace. But apparently an armed guard did stop him, and the Secret Service said, please get back into your car, Mr. President.
But former President Jimmy Carter having none of that. Dahlia Lithwick, do you think we'll see George Bush standing in the African sun one day, I don't know, shouting at Sudanese security guards?
I'm going to stick with my earlier comment that we're going to see him with a gold card at Saks first.
Oh, boy. There's an image. I don't know. Dahlia Lithwick with Slate. It's been great having you, as always. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Liz Mayer, political blogger and columnist for the New York Sun. Liz, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Jack, always good to have you. Have a great weekend, my friend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.